And then please turn in your Bibles to Daniel chapter 11, and we are in verses 20 through 35. I know it's difficult for us to go through these verses. I am taking 3 Sundays to do this. The last time I did it in one Sunday. I just cut right down to verse 36, which is future from our perspective. But from Daniel's perspective, all of this was future. Now, I think Colin was telling me that he spent some time looking at the historical reference from last Sunday and was amazed at the volume of information that's out there. And you can track these guys. I've given their full names, so if you want to go and read about it. And also in 1st and 2nd Maccabees, there's a lot of historical background. I quote a little bit of it here, but Maccabees has all kinds of historical background information as well. And it's irrelevant. Okay, look up here. It doesn't matter. All right, so what you need to understand Scripture is here in these verses. And he goes through massive amounts of casualties and wars and conflicts and generals, and he spends zero time on it. Okay, not zero time. He just kind of rolls right by it, and this and this and this and this and this and something else, and this and don't forget that. And he just rolls right along it, and then he gets to this guy called Antiochus Epiphanes, where we'll be in verse 21. So we'll do one verse and then get to Antiochus Epiphanes. And then he spends from verse 21 to 35 dealing with this Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, why does he blow by Alexander the Great in half a verse? And why does he blow by 4 incredible Persian kings in one verse? And then spend all these verses on Antiochus Epiphanes? And the answer is because that's what's important. It's important because it has to do with the nation of Israel. So when you look at a biblical perspective, biblical view of history, Israel is at the heart of soul of everything of that God is doing. It's all about Israel. It's always all about Israel. All right? And the world is under God's wrath until Israel is in the land and has believed in the Messiah. So Antiochus Epiphanes becomes a major player in this because he does stuff that nobody else does that Antichrist is going to do. So for you, you're going to be really interested in the coming information about Antichrist. And what I'll, Lord willing, give you another handout, and we'll complete our study of the characteristics of the Antichrist from the book of Daniel. You say, what relevance does that have to me? I won't be here. Well, that's true. However, it had great relevance to the Thessalonians, the folks in Thessalonia. They needed that information because they were told that they were in the tribulation. Well, that's a major problem because Paul taught them that they wouldn't go through the tribulation. And one of his arguments was very simple. You're not in the tribulation. Look around you. Do you see this guy called Antichrist? No Antichrist, no tribulation. You cannot have the tribulation without the Antichrist. It's that simple. So God gave us lots of specific characteristics, and we'll complete that. All right, so no matter who you are, on page 3 of your uninspired handout, you can follow along. This is verses 20 through 35, where we are today. And he shall arise in his place, one causing to travel across, one who traverses, and one, while he's traveling across, is collecting taxes of the glorious kingdom. So this guy, he's going to come along, and I've given you his name, and also in 2 Maccabees 3, you can read about this fellow. He sent his minister of finance to collect money from the temple in Jerusalem. And according to Maccabees, he had some vision and it scared him, and he was prevented from taking money. but then he went back and poisoned the guy who sent them. So apparently his alleged conversion, didn't extend to murder by poison. But in verse 20, you'll see that this guy, Seleucus the Fourth, Philopater, he taxed everybody, including specifically, as the angel is interested in, the glorious kingdom, which is Israel. And in the days, days of ones, in a very short period of time, he will just be destroyed, and not in anger, and not in a battle. How did he die? His minister of finance poisoned him. No, don't get any ideas for United States, okay? All right, 21 now, we're dealing with the vile person. This is Antiochus Epiphanes. He took that name for himself. It means the illustrious one, the manifest one. This guy was all about ego, presentation, deception, lies. He is the epitome of what politics has come to be known. Okay, unfortunately. But he usurped the throne through political manipulation. The guy who should have gotten the throne was actually in jail. I can't remember where he was in jail. But he wasn't available. And so this guy stepped up and he did all kinds of stuff. Let's look at verse 21. And he shall arise in his place, one being contemptible, one being despised. Our text says a vile person. And they will not give over him the honor of a kingdom or royalty. So, yeah, he's going to be king, but nobody is going to honor him as king because they all know he really shouldn't be king because he kind of cheated his way into the kingship. Again, no parallels. But nobody's going to respect him. This guy is a despicable, contemptible, vile human being. And he comes in peace and he establishes himself over the kingdom in empty flatteries. So the way he gets into power, according to verse 21, is not by war or military power, but by being a flattering, lying, useless guy. He's good with words. Verse 22 here, he does, once he's in power, by the way, there was a play on words. He called himself Epiphanes, and they called him the madman, Epiphanes. It's a play on words, so a little Greek background there. So let's look, please, at verse 22. An army of the flood, they shall be swept away from before his face. So he puts together a massive army, and they shall be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. So he's going to come along with a relatively small number of people, and he's going to gain power and get into force. And also, he murdered the high priest, who was priest in Jerusalem. He broke that. They shall be broken before him. And also the prince of the covenant, he got him murdered, and that was in 172 BC. Verse 23, and from the alliances with him, he will do deceptively, deceitfully. So he gets a bunch of people, a bunch of alliances, and then he lies. He promises one thing and he does something else. And he will go up and be strong with a few people. So with a relatively small number of people, he came into power and he did some interesting things here in verse 24. In the place, in peace, and in the richness of the province, he will come. So what he's going to do is go in peace to a very rich province. He goes there and he will do what his fathers have not done and the fathers of his fathers have not done. the plunder and the spoil and the wealth or possessions that are to Antiochus Epiphanes and his allies, he will distribute. And the term that he uses here has the nuance of distributing out shares. And over the fortress, he will plot his plans up until a time. So Antiochus Epiphanes goes into the richest provinces of his countries, and he takes them and he distributes them to the poorer parts of the countries. Now, this is not something that is unfamiliar to us, but this was the first time that you have socialism that I'm aware of in the history of the world. This guy did something that nobody else had done. Every other ruler before him, when you captured it in battle, you kept it for yourself. Okay, that was how it rolls. The spoils go to the king and his army and the families of the armies. That's how it was. This guy didn't do that. He redistributed the wealth. Now, in our culture, in our country, this is a very familiar concept. And we're seeing a real push in our country to take from the wealthy. They have to pay their fair share. Have you heard that before? And this is a new concept to us, but it's been around for a long time. And what I've seen in my own experience, for what it's worth, is that the philosophy of saving or deferring appetites, deferring consumption, has been lost as our cultures have rolled forward. So my parents were products of the Depression. All right, my mom and dad, they were incredibly frugal. They saved everything. They saved all of the time. They never spent 100% of what they had. The first 10% went to the Lord, the second 10% went into savings, and they never touched that second 10%. They lived on less than 70%. The greater the savings, the less they lived on. That was that generation. Guys like Sam Walton and Ralph Eaton, these names of famous millionaires, billionaires, that's what they did. Sam Walton, he started Sam's Club. He started Walmart. There was a Walmart over at the corner of 15th and Custer on the southeast corner there. And I was talking to the lady who runs the little snack bar. In those days, they sold hot dogs and chips with yellow sauce on them, that sort of thing, sodas. And she was telling me about the time Sam Walton came to visit. She said, all of a sudden, here's this little guy, and he's jumped himself up on the counter with his head behind the cash register, and he's looking this way and that at the single aisle kitchen. And so she comes over and she says, "May I help you?" And he says, "Yes, I'm Sam Walton, and I want to see how you're taking care of my store." He drove an old pickup truck. You know, they saved and they were frugal. So when I look at my parents, I was a product of them, and they had a saying, "If it doesn't eat bread, keep it." Thank you, Mrs. Effa. Absolutely. If it doesn't eat bread, keep it, because you never know when you're going to need it. You know, in recent years, I finally graduated to a little different philosophy. It's all right if it stays on the shelves of Home Depot. But boy, do I wish I had kept it. That's how my world views. Okay, so, you know, I'm a baby boomer, and we spent a whole lot more than our parents did. The result of that is that you end up with your Generation X, and then your Millennials, and then your Generation Z. As this rolls forward, the baby boom generation basically outsourced all kinds of jobs and companies overseas. And then when our children, which were less than the baby boomers, came along, they found less resources until now you get the products of the millennials, of the Generation Z, and their worldview comes out of September 11th, 2000, and what was it, 2001. And their worldview is we're all going to die and it's not going to stay around. And there's no way we can get the education we need to amass it. So it's only right that what you've saved now goes to us. And so the worldview has moved to a redistribution of wealth. And you wonder, you know, people my age, they sit there and I listen to the idea of socialism that is now permeating our universities and our campuses and our young people. And I think, where did that come from? Antiochus Epiphanes. So he came and he took from the wealthy and then he redistributed among his empire. So the people who were rich, what are they going to do about it? They're under subjugation. And the people that are poor, well, they're now on his team. They're on his payroll, so to speak. So in verse 24, he says that this has not happened before. His fathers didn't do it. His father's fathers didn't do it. Where you take from the wealthy, the plunder, the spoils, the possessions, and you distribute them over your fortresses, and then you plant, you make these plans. So his way of expanding his empire was not through military might, but rather through crafty planning and negotiations. All right, well, we got this much money from this province. Let's go down there and buy that province with promises and with money. Okay? Let's now look, please, at verse 25. He will agitate. He means he stirs up. Why didn't he leave well enough alone? Well, because like all good socialists, it's never enough. You always need more. You know the old adage of old Mother Hubbard. Eventually you go to the cupboard and there's nothing left to give the poor dog a bone. He will agitate, stir up his power and his heart over the king of the south with a great army. So he needs more. If you're going to win by subterfuge and buying, then you need more. So he gets himself worked up into a frenzy, and he's going to go with a great army against the king of the south. And the king of the south, this is Egypt, will initiate action to battle with a very, very great and mighty army. So now you have massive armies, and he here refers to the king of the south, and he will not stand because they will devise plans against him. The ones eating the delicacies, the fine food, the ones sitting at his table and eating dessert, they will destroy him. And his army will be swept away, and they will be fallen down, slaying a whole bunch of people. So the southern army, this was a pretty young king, it's destroyed and swept away before Antiochus Epiphanes. Verse 27, you would think that Antiochus Epiphanes would then reign victorious over the king of the south. But remember, he's a conniving, he's a word craftsman. He's a flatterer. Then the two of them, the two kings, will in their heart do evil over the very same table. Over one table, these two kings, the king of the north and the king of the south, who's been vanquished by the king of the north, they're going to sit down at the same table, which in the angels' worldview is, how in the world could they possibly eat together and lie through their teeth? Because when you have a meal together, you're supposed to be honest. And they will be speaking lies, and it will not succeed because again and again for the appointed time, he says, the end is for an appointed time. So what happened in history was that Antiochus Epiphanes came down there and he made Ptolemy king of Memphis because another king had been set up in Alexandria, and they thought he thought he could leave him there. But the reality is he went back home, and Antiochus never ruled Egypt, and Ptolemy never regained authority. All right, verse 28. And he will return to his land up north, headed north, in great riches. And his heart over the holy covenant. So he's going to, as he goes back, decide to do damage to Israel. And he will do, and he will return to his land. So now we're all the way down to verse 29, which will take us to page 4 in your uninspired notes. The appointed time is 168. This is the time when they decide to have another round of wars, king of the north and the king of the south. And at the appointed time, he will return. This is verse 29. He will return and enter in the south and enter into the king of the south's domain, and will not be like the first time nor like the latter time. So he's had two invasions so far. This one is not going to be like that. Why not, you say? Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because verse 30 introduces a very interesting and new issue that has not been heard of before. And they shall come against him, ships of Kittim is the Hebrew here. Cyprus is some of your terms. Kittim is the ancient Genesis 10 name for these western Mediterranean regions. This is Rome. Alan was telling us about pigs in Rome this morning. Here we are looking at this section. These ships come down to Egypt. So ships from Kittim, and he will be broken. That's all it says. But a Roman commander, Gaius Pompilius Lanus, met Antiochus 4 miles outside of Alexandria. So he's way down in Egypt, and these ships come, and this Roman general from the Senate hands Antiochus Epiphanes a letter. Kind of cool. He took and drew a circle around Antiochus Epiphanes, because this guy is a wordsmith, right? He's going to lie at every chance that he can. So the Roman commander, with all the troops, both troops, standing on the shore there, he draws a circle around Antiochus, and he says, "You cannot step out of this circle until you answer this letter from Rome. So either you obey the Roman Senate," you see the power shift here, "you obey the Roman Senate, or we're going to do battle right now on this shore." And Antiochus knew that he couldn't beat Rome. So he turns around and he agrees to abide by that edict rather than face the Roman troops. So he withdrew in defeat and humiliation. He takes his troops, whom he promised all kinds of riches of Egypt, and he turns around and he starts the long journey home back up into Asia Minor. So he's got to go through Israel to get there, and this is the important part of the history. "And return, and he will wage war over the holy covenant, and he will do and return and take note over the ones abandoning the holy covenant." So as he goes back there, what he does is pay attention to everybody in Israel that is a Hellenist. That's where this term comes from. This division still exists in the New Testament. These were Jews who abandoned their Judaism in order to not have conflict with Antiochus Epiphanes. "And armies from him will arise," his armies will arise, "and they will defile the holy place," the stronghold, and the defile is emphatic. The way they defiled it was by taking away all of the religious protocols of the Jews and actually sacrificing a pig on the altar. And he erected an image of Zeus in the holy place. And he put the altar was this image was erected on December 15th, 1967, and on Christmas In 167, the pig was offered, pigs were offered on the altar. So he totally desecrated the Jewish temple. And they will give the abomination that has caused people and everything to have been appalled. The abomination that makes appalling desolation. So that's verse 31. Now, this is important because this is what the Antichrist does. You're going to see this in the verses following. So the angel goes through a whole lot of huge history, important from history's perspective, but not important as far as the Jews are concerned. Now he expands it and he goes through this guy. You want a type of Antichrist? Antiochus Epiphanes. Well, what about Hitler? Well, Hitler didn't do what Antiochus Epiphanes did. Well, he slaughtered all those Jews. Yeah, but he didn't set an image of himself up in the temple. Why not? Well, there wasn't a temple. Okay, no temple, no Antichrist. You can't do that. We have to have the tribulation temple built. So this guy parallels what the Antichrist is doing. And so the angel gives us lots of information about this. So they will, this abomination of desolation. And then ones causing, the ones causing wickedness of the covenant, they will be defiling, they will cause defiling in flattery. So those Hellenists who sided with Antiochus Epiphanes, they're going to multiply their education, trying to persuade people to follow the Antichrist, or in this case, Antiochus Epiphanes. The parallels are exact. And the ones knowing their God, they will stand firm and they will have some success. They will do. So you have this division in Israel among the Jews between those who understand what's going on and those who are playing politics. And the ones, verse 33, and the ones causing people to understand, they will cause many to understand. So there will be giving out of truth in the face of Antiochus Epiphanes and in the face of the Antichrist. But these ones who understand, they will fall. That means they will die by the sword and by fire and by captivity and by plundering for a certain number of days. Verse 34. And when they, that is the ones who have understanding, when they have stumbled, they will be helped with a little bit of help. And they will be joined by, there will be ones who join them, many will join them for the wrong reasons, not because they understand, but because they're sick of the political environment in which they live. Verse 35, and from the ones who are understanding, they will have been stumbled. They're going to fall. And they're going to die. These persecutions that are going to be poured out upon them, many of them are going to die. And the purpose of that, he says, is to refine them and to purify them and to make them white until the time of the end, because this is the time that has been appointed. So the angel's history leading up to this point focuses on this guy called Antiochus Epiphanes, because this is the kind of thing that will parallel exactly the Antichrist, which is what it takes for Israel to finally be cured of its love affair with pagan powers and to surrender themselves in faith to the Lord Jesus.